Welcome into another edition of the Dana Victory Podcast, only on MusketeerReport.com. As always, I'm Rick. He's Dan. And Dan Xavier split the last two games since last week when we talked, played LaSalle at home, beat them over the weekend, and then lost a tough one last night, which was Wednesday night. I should add that we're recording this on Thursday evening around 7:15 here.
Yeah, so this is episode number 19, which is a positive number given the All-Star Game announcement, I guess, earlier this week.
I'm glad you came through with this one.
Muskies beat LaSalle 70-63, moved to 4-0 in the A-10. A lot of optimism going around, but little dose of reality, and we'll talk about this a little bit more later in the show with last night's 63-57 loss at Charlotte. Some of the old problems that the Musketeers evinced during their four game slide coming into conference play reared their ugly heads. But we'll analyze those a little bit more. We'll also talk a little bit about the week to come, and it is a huge week for the Muskies on the floor. On Saturday evening, 6 p.m. tip off, they'll play at St. Joseph's at Hagen Arena in Philadelphia, and then on Wednesday night, 9 p.m. they'll put the infamous Jimmy Carter streak on the line as they host the Dayton Flyers. Two games against pretty good A-10 competition. And, you know, this is kind of a make-or-break week for the Musketeers, I think. I think if they'd have gotten that Charlotte win, they might be able to absorb a loss in these next two games and still keep their hopes for the A-10 title alive. But as it stands, you look at those two games right now through the lens of where the Musketeers are with VCU undefeated in the league, and it is a big week. But before we get to our typical analysis of the week that was, we've got a really special guest on the podcast tonight, a guy we've wanted to get on for a while, a guy that's I think is going to give I'm looking forward to this interview because I think it's going to be one of the more enlightening interviews and guests that we've had about how a college basketball program works and functions.
Without question, really excited to bring this guy in. I guess if you had to rank him, he'd probably fall somewhere ahead of Brian Snow, but maybe not quite at the level of Andy Mack. That's a tough nut to crack there up at the top. But we are talking about the first ever director of basketball administration at Xavier, Mario Mercurio. Mario, how are you doing?
Great, Rick. How are you?
Couldn't be better. Pleasure to have you on. Well, first things first, let's just start here because I don't think a lot of our fans actually know exactly what it is you do. You were the first to ever hold this position at Xavier. Tell us, what does your job title entail as the director of basketball administration, and then what's a typical day like for you at Xavier?
You know, most of my responsibilities are just that, administrative. You know, when I first came to Xavier, a lot of the duties, like scheduling, like the budget, like travel, were split amongst the assistant coaches. And what they decided was to take all those duties and centralize them with one person rather than have them split across the board. And, you know, what it did, most importantly, was give those guys, the coaches, more of an opportunity to focus on what they're best on, you know, what they're best doing, and that's coaching. Giving an assistant coach more time to focus on workouts with guys, being on the road recruiting, stuff like that that's basketball centered, as opposed to, you know, hitting the phones and dealing with scheduling, you know, handling travel and all that other administrative stuff, was a great benefit, and it still remains as such for our staff. A typical day for me, it could vary from anything, honest to God. If it's camp time, you know, I'll be working with Jeremy Groh in terms of our camps. You know, scheduling is something I'll work on every day. Travel this time of year is an everyday nightmare as well. And there's a lot of different areas of campus I work with in terms of, you know, dealing with our alumni relations, dealing with the fundraising end of things with Becky Jackson. There's probably no script to my day, to be honest.
Well, and certainly when you have issues like that unexpected cold snap up in New York last week, your job becomes a lot harder on the fly. Mario, you mentioned scheduling as a part of your sort of something that's in your purview. You know, we hear a lot from different schools about what their overarching scheduling philosophy is. Gonzaga makes a lot of their anywhere, anytime idea. You know, you'll see big schools like Ohio State and Syracuse. It'll play a couple marquee, maybe neutral site non-conference games and then fill the rest of their schedule with cupcakes. You've been doing this for a while. You've been working with different coaches, with obviously Mike Babinski, the outgoing AD. Is it possible for you to sort of sum up what Xavier's scheduling philosophy is?
I would say our scheduling philosophy could be really simply stated as putting us in a position every year not to just make the NCAA tournament, but to receive the best seed we can possibly receive. And if you look at since 2002, twice we've earned a 3 seed. We've had a 4 seed, 2 6 seeds, and 2 7 seeds. And if you think about that and you think about the schedules that we put together those years, it's a complete package. You know, your non-conference schedule has to reflect a team that can not only take on different challenges, but win at the same time. So for us, we look at each and every year as an opportunity to say, what can we do in the months of November and December to put us in that position? What can we do to go on the road and get those big road wins, be savvy about what we're doing at home and allowing us to beat great RPI teams at home? And what opportunities are there with different tournaments that can give you great exposure, put you in a position to play 3 high major games on a neutral court? That's what I would say would be our scheduling philosophy.
Mario, that's extremely interesting when you talk about that. But when you go into the process of actually putting this together, the schedule, and you're trying to find these games and fill these different contracts that are coming up, how do you go about that? I mean, is it a lot of you talking with the coaches, trying to figure out who might be available, who they'd like to play? Is it a lot of what you just mentioned? We got to worry about the RPI and other measures that are used for the NCAA tournament. I mean, how do you actually come up with who you're going to schedule or who you're going to reach out to try to schedule?
I'll tell you, the most important part of scheduling isn't necessarily who you play. It's when you play it and the flow of your schedule. So the first thing we'll do is we'll take a blank calendar, put a star on the second Friday of November. That's your opening day. And then before we even know the names of the opponents, we'll really think about what do we want to accomplish with each passing week. You usually know at that point where your exempt event is. In the past, we'll usually know at that point when the UC game will be. You'll know when exam week is. You'll know when Thanksgiving is. And you'll know when Christmas is. And at that point, you say, okay, I want to start at home with the guarantee game. What do you want to do next? And you kind of chip away week by week. And you make those decisions up front without knowing opponents because they become unconditional decisions. You know, you're not swayed one way or another by a big name opponent or an opportunity that might pop up that doesn't necessarily fit in there. You make those decisions and say, you know what, that UC game, that's going to be a big, big game. We want to be smart about what we do after and what we do before. Exam week, you want to be smart about what you do after and what you do before. You take into consideration things like, when are the students in town? You know, when are they back from break? Different stuff like that that is over and beyond necessarily the actual opponent. Once you have that map, then you can kind of start that process of filling those items in. You know, we schedule 11 games, one of which is always going to be the UC game. 6 of them are going to be high major series, and it's designed as such that we can start 3 of those on the road each year. And then the other 3 are usually the previous year's games returned to the Cintas Center. And then the remaining 4 games are guarantee games. And as you guys know, as well as anybody, our goal with those games is to really find the best possible guarantee games. What conferences are the strongest that allow you to buy their teams? Then taking a look at who's probably going to be picked to win that conference. And unfortunately, we've actually taken some lumps in past years during guarantee games. But you look at some of those opponents, you know, Bucknell, Belmont, Wofford, Robert Morris, you know, they're NCAA level teams. And that kind of comprises the process to really start putting a schedule together.
Well, Mario, you mentioned 6 high major series you look at every year, 3 to start at home, 3 to start on the road. This year, there are a few that are probably going to be rotating off after this season. I know Memphis is the return game at Cintas this year. Already had the Vandy. And Purdue returns. Are you know, Can you tell us anything about who you anticipate may be candidates to be on the schedule, or give us some profiles of the type of team you're looking for to fill those slots?
You know, the first thing you'd say is who we have coming back. We'll have Tennessee at home, and we'll have Wake at home. Obviously, the other high major will be playing at Cincinnati downtown. And then, as you mentioned, you have three starting on the road. We've talked to a lot of schools, you know, from the farthest of the West Coast to the the farthest of the East Coast. Nothing has really gotten put on paper at this point. There's great opportunities, but again, it's just you got to really weigh a lot of different options. And at this point, nothing has really emerged as let's get this one done. I do think we'll be a part of the marathon again with ESPN. I thought that was an awesome event this year with Butler. They do a great job of promoting it online. You know, it's a special day in terms of the coverage that they offer. I think one of those three series that we start on the road will be a part of that marathon.
As a fan, that was a really cool event to have a 4 o'clock tip off, to have sort of the eyes of the country on CentOS Center for that. Hey Mario, I had one other question that we had sort of shared with you when we emailed back and forth earlier, which was to maybe talk about what you think the biggest misconception people have about the scheduling process is. Like, you know, from the fan's perspective or from an outsider's perspective, what do you think people miss about this process? And you may have already answered that, but
you know, I think I touched on it a little bit, and that's the importance of the flow of your schedule and the balance. Never really compromising what you're trying to accomplish for that one opportunity. You know, to be very candid, I know our fans would love to see us play Kentucky and Duke. So would I. The likelihood of having a series with either of those teams is very slim. They don't typically play home and homes, and when they do, it's to be frank, they're not going to play at Xavier. And a lot of people will ask, why don't you just go play a game down there? Let them give you $150,000. The game's on ESPN. What's to keep you from doing that, especially if you're trying to build a resume? And I understand that point, and I hear the point that they're making. But by the same respects, think about what you're compromising for future years. You know, what am I giving up to go be bought by Kentucky? Am I giving up a series? Well, okay, if I'm giving up a series, you're giving up that return game the following year. Am I giving up a guarantee game? Okay, you're giving up the opportunity to probably beat a pretty good team at home, the revenue that comes with a home game. So you really got to evaluate each of those decisions. You got to take the emotions out of it. I can't tell you the opportunities that, unfortunately, we passed up on in different series that we've decided not to take just because it didn't feel right up front. You know, a lot of times when you put something on paper in June, you know, the year before a game takes place, it's one thing. When you're staring down the crosshairs of that game and, you know, you're playing your third straight road game in the non-conference just because you got excited about an idea 9 months ago, doesn't always pan out the way you'd hope it would. You know, another question I get asked is, why don't we do a big road swing? Why don't we go play UCLA and then go to Stanford? Again, those both sound great, but the idea of traveling with a travel party of what's now 42 people, getting in a plane, going to Los Angeles, playing a game, taking 2 days off on the West Coast, playing another game, and then coming back, you can't understand what that takes out of a team. So I would say misconception is probably a strong word, but that would probably be the thing that gets a little undervalued. You know, the flow of your schedule, the way you design it to take into consideration saving your guys' legs, using your home court to your advantage. Little pieces like that probably get missed in the puzzle.
Mario, you mentioned UK and Duke there, and you know, why haven't you scheduled a game with them? Is there another series out there that you've wanted to schedule and haven't been able to get done? Is there one that you've always kind of said, man, I wish we could get that one done?
You know, not necessarily. I will be, you know, to be really candid with you, the last one I felt that way about was Florida. I love Florida's program. It was a great environment. Honestly, that game is one of the top four or five games I'll always remember during my time at Xavier. That was something for me personally I was real excited about. The return game obviously didn't go our way, but again, awesome environment, great team, big-time players. I don't necessarily have anything out there that, like, for me personally, I would be excited about. if there's a cosmetic aspect to what I do in scheduling, like I do like to try to find newer teams. Tom Iser has a page in our media guide with our series records versus all Division I teams. And, you know, I'll take a look at that once in a while and see who haven't we played in a while? Who haven't we played at all? I try to make an effort, again, keeping travel in mind to see if we can sneak out to the West Coast, see if we can play a Big 12 team, get in an area we haven't been in a while. You know, I think the Xavier brand is important, you know, not just for athletics, but just for our entire school, getting us to an area where people might not be familiar with Xavier, and you can kind of push that brand, I think, is a cool byproduct of what we can do.
Mario, one last question on the scheduling, and we'll move on to a couple other things real quick. Assuming for the sake that Xavier joins this, whatever Catholic 7 league might be called, you get into a conference that theoretically would be better. You're going to have to play tougher games in your conference schedule. How much would that change your philosophy and the way you have to schedule non-conference?
You know, the first thing I'd say, Rick, you can't undervalue the current conference we're in. And I know there's been a lot of criticism of the Atlantic 10 in the past, but the current state of the Atlantic 10, it's as strong as it's ever been. You look at the current run we're in at Charlotte, at St. Joe's, home against Dayton, at Richmond. You look at the way we end the conference schedule. VCU, UMass, St. Louis, at Butler. I appreciate that there's probably some tougher stretches out there in different conferences, but man, like those two sequences I just talked about, those are really, really hard sequences. So when you talk about going to a conference with smaller teams or stronger teams, I appreciate that, but I think you do got to acknowledge the conference we're in, pretty, pretty strong. If we were to make that switch or if something were to come up, and, you know, obviously the climate in college athletics is always changing, you know, I think it would be very realistic to say we would take a sharp look at our schedule. Maybe we'd make some changes. Maybe we wouldn't. You know, would that theoretical conference be playing 16 games a year? Would it be playing 20? You know, a lot of different questions would have to be answered. You know, but I could assure you that the goal wouldn't change. You know, we would always schedule to get the best possible seed. We'd always have a focus on getting an at-large bid to the NCAA tournament. Those things would obviously never change.
Mario, one last question, sort of a follow-up on that. After this season, we know Temple's going to be leaving the Atlantic 10, and if there is a Catholic 7, they're not going to be a part of that league. There's at least a non-zero chance that a school like Dayton may not have a league affiliation with Xavier if this comes about and they choose to go, you know, 9 or 10 teams like we've talked about in the past. Do you think that the prevailing wisdom would be to try and accommodate some of those existing, you know, with Dayton, definitely a rivalry with Temple, sort of a game that's become a yearly huge date on the Xavier schedule. Would there be an effort made to accommodate those existing series, or do you think they would just sort of go into the mix with everything else if there's this upheaval in the next few years?
Again, all speaking in hypotheticals, you know, I think we would be really savvy about the decisions we'd make with regards to that. You know, I think the rivalries in our conference are obvious, especially with Dayton. You know, an undervalued rivalry is the one we're about to play in a couple of days against St. Joe's. You know, when I think about our time in the Atlantic 10 over the last decade, like the St. Joe's games really stick out to me almost more than any other game. You think about Marvin O'Connor, you think about Jameer Nelson, Delonte West. My favorite all-time game at Xavier, regardless of NCAA tournament or anything, came in David West's senior year when we won at St. Joe's. Obviously, another fan favorite comes with our win over St. Joe's when they were ranked number one at UD Arena in the tournament. You know, that would be, me personally, a series I would like to keep going. And obviously, the Dayton series, you know, we're speaking, obviously, if they weren't included in any kind of new hybrid conference, that series would have a lot of value as well. But again, all that is just hypotheticals for a couple fans on here talking.
Exactly,
obviously,
right.
There's obviously a lot to pan out.
Exactly, and we could continue talking about that the rest of the night. So I'm going to have to move on, because otherwise Dan and I will sit here for the next 2 hours just talking to you about scheduling and other teams you'd like to play. This is my favorite part of your job, obviously. the Nike contract. You've got the Nike NTS contract. It's a big deal. But for all of us fans and regular people out here who don't necessarily know what all goes into that, what's it mean? What do you get out of it? What's this mean for Xavier to have that contract?
You know, it seems like a small thing on the surface, but I can assure you that inside of a program, especially when it comes to recruiting, it's as big as it gets. You know, there are very few things cosmetically and physically that you can give a player when they come to your school. Obviously, free tuition is a big thing along with books and room and board. But that next thing in line, being the type of gear and your equipment supplier, is a big one. And it's something that I'm not embarrassed to say that our staff enjoys and our players enjoy. And we were fortunate enough to get a major upgrade a couple years ago to the NTS level. And what that did was allow us to have access to their designers. Everything that comes to us is fully customized based on our guys' size. It's honestly remarkable the things that they've done for us. The Sandy Hook jerseys, the throwback jerseys, different stuff like that is great examples of those things that you guys can see every day.
Mario, one thing that's been immediately obvious the last 3 or 4 years, when you look around college basketball, a lot of the manufacturers have pretty homogenous uniform templates, and you'll see a lot of schools that have a similar looking identity just in their individual colors and logos. But X has a unique look and a very clean, unique is the only word I can come up with. Can you give us some insight into how the current Xavier uniforms were designed and developed and sort of what the priorities were as you worked with Nike to create that look?
Yeah, certainly. You know, the when we made the transition to the NTS level, we had a quick conversation with Nike. And they asked us what was important to us, and obviously we talk about how much we stress our logo and the X, and they kind of just took that piece and ran with it. Our shorts, our whole uniform, in fact, is one of a kind. And you know, I know if you take a close look and you're a gear guy, you can kind of see, man, school A and school B have pretty much the same uniform, just a couple different colors. And with us, we're the only team in the country that has our design, and it's something we take a lot of pride in.
And then I think it's been reported a few different places that X may be getting new uniforms next year, revamping the design. I know you're probably not allowed to give us too many details, but can you give us some idea of what sort of the conversations have been about as far as identity and as far as the tweaks that may be made?
You know what? We love our current jerseys. And as our three-year – your jerseys are in a three-year cycle with – it's tied in with retail. And when we revisit it, what the next phase with those is going to be, we were pretty adamant about keeping the same type of style, especially the shorts. They're switching us to what they refer to as a new silhouette. It's basically going to be different fabric. It has a hyper elite style on the left and right side of the short, which has like some holes for venting. Really discreet. Honestly, probably wouldn't even see them on TV. The jersey top, again, the front and the numbering will all be the same. The back will have the sublimated print to it, and they've kind of simplified that. You know, last year I think you saw some different designs where they would incorporate parts of the school and different parts of the logo, and they're kind of downplaying it a little bit and making it a very discreet X with a net behind it. Pretty sharp, honestly, nothing that would stand out to the point where it would offend somebody or look gaudy, but you can obviously tell it's there. The biggest change, I think, is scheduled to be with the steel jerseys, as they call them. I believe they're going to switch the numbering and lettering on those from navy to white. So kind of giving it a more, I don't know if I would say a softer look, but it'll kind of be more of a blended look. And those, from what I've seen in the sketches, are really, really sharp.
Well, let's stay right on that steel subject, because those are my favorite jerseys without question. First of all, I love the steel color. I don't like gray jerseys necessarily for everyone, but for whatever reason, with the Xavier look right now, I think the gray or the steel looks awesome. Can you clear this up for the fans? We were talking about this on the message board the other day. You've had a lot of success in them recently. What are the rules as far as alternate jerseys? Is there any type of limit on those? And do you predict that we'll see some more steel at the Cintas Center with the success they've had?
There are no rules. If you think about it, this year we'll wear a navy jersey, a white jersey, the gray steel color jerseys. We had a throwback jersey that we're going to wear for VCU, and we obviously wore the Sandy Hook jerseys versus Wofford. So there's not necessarily any cap on what you can or can't do. You know, that's kind of that Oregon football culture that's spread throughout college athletics. With regards to what we'll wear moving forward, I think we'll stick with a certain pattern here until it's proven to be not successful.
So we could theoretically see the Dayton game next Wednesday be black on gray, which is sort of steel. I'm sorry, black on steel.
That's right.
Mario, you've overseen over your period sort of administering this contract a number of different throwback uniforms, including sort of probably the most famous one being what I guess they would call a faux back, which was the Cincinnati Royals style design for Midnight Madness last year. I know you're pretty proud of that. We've also seen the 1958 look that X wore against St. Joe's, I think Josh Duncan's senior year. We've seen a Prosser era style with Musketeers across the front. We've seen the Gillen style that was worn last year, I think, and I'm blanking on which game it was. I think the Temple game last year. Which of those throwback uniforms or throwing the Royals uniform in there is your favorite and why?
You know, the one with the Running Man logo on it is my favorite. I have Josh Duncan's. They sent us two Josh Duncan versions, and I have the one that he didn't play in hanging in my office. I thought that was sharp because I know that a lot of equity was built up in the Running Man logo, and it's something that a lot of people take pride in. And I thought that was probably the most unique one and the one that probably had the best response. The Royals one was really cool, too. I think anytime you can kind of tie in your city and the sports culture that comes with your city, I think that's really cool. The Oklahoma City Thunder wore a version of them the other night, and I kind of got a little laugh out of that.
Mario, wrapping up here real quick, just something that's completely kind of off the topic, the UC game being moved this year to US Bank Arena, with you being in charge of scheduling, how much have talk has gone on since then about where this game will continue to be played? I mean, I know there's still another year on that contract, but what has there been much communication at all, or has it kind of just been left alone since then?
You know, honestly, we have a great relationship with UC staff. It's probably something people don't realize. I talk to Drew on their staff once, maybe twice a week, just bouncing different scheduling stuff off of one another, different travel stuff. We haven't necessarily talked about the future of that series beyond next year. You know, I think everybody understood that it's going to be a 2-year deal down there. This year, there were some home elements tied in to just UC. I think anyone who went to the game would have realized that you saw UC advertisements on the digital board down there. You heard more UC music than Xavier music. And they did a good job with the intros allowing both teams to have intros, but they were clearly UC elements to this year's game. Next year, the reverse will be obviously true. It'll be Xavier elements. And I think we both felt like we'll get through these 2 years and then kind of make an informed decision of where we're at.
Mario, unbelievable stuff. We really appreciate you coming on. I think, you know, the fans, when they hear this, are going to be enlightened on a lot of different things that have gone into Xavier basketball over the years and what you've brought. Really appreciate you coming on, and maybe we can do it again sometime.
Absolutely. I appreciate having the opportunity to talk with you guys.
Okay. Well, once again, we want to thank Mario Mercurio for appearing on the podcast. Great interview. You know, when Rick and I met the first time to talk about this podcast and sort of dream up some ideas for this, I think it was at a Reds game, right, Rick?
It was before a Reds game, but yeah.
Before a Reds game over a few beers. One of the things that I think we had talked about that would be interesting is getting people in that could talk about the different facets of how a big-time basketball program operates. And obviously Mario, with his expertise on scheduling and the sort of marketing travel aspects of it, is definitely one of those people. You know, we want to give you analysis of the games. We want to give you some recruiting analysis in addition to what you get from Rick and from Brian, but also to maybe – This is a forum where we can get some more insight into how the program runs on a day-to-day basis. So certainly great to have Mario on to discuss that.
Yeah, he killed it. That was pretty strong for a first timer.
Well, most of our first-timers don't come back, so.
That's a good point. But, hey, we're working on it. It's still young. We're only at the Joey Votto episode.
We're going to talk. Going to go through the two games that were played this week. As we mentioned at the top of the show, a split, as everyone's aware. We'll start with the good news. Last Saturday afternoon, the Musketeers played the LaSalle Explorers. And I have to be very careful about saying LaSalle Explorers because having grown up in Cincinnati, I always want to say LaSalle Lancers.
I do the same thing every freaking time.
Final score of that game, 70-63, although the final score a little bit misleading. X gave up, I think, 11 straight points with the walk-ons at the end of the game. It was a pretty commanding win. And Rick, to me, the story of this game was X's response to LaSalle's early run.
Yeah, it was the response to the early run, but the thing I think when you look at that early run is something we've talked about a lot this year, and that's that it never got out of control. LaSalle had the early momentum for sure, but Xavier played – they were playing physical on the defensive end. They were engaged, and it just took a little while. We haven't really seen this from this team. We've seen a lot of quick starts, and then they fade quickly, but we haven't seen them have that sort of lull right off the beginning of the game. And it was kind of weird because they've been kind of – that's kind of been their MO this year, is the one thing that's always been there for them has been energy and effort. This game, it was kind of like a weird beginning, and things didn't look promising, but – the effort was still there for the most part, and when things got rolling, I mean, they really came on quickly in that first half. I think the biggest thing was just the defensive effort, and mainly by the guards. Having D. Davis back for this game was huge.
Yeah, the Musketeers fell behind 20-9 early on. Ramon Galloway, who we knew was going to be a critical player for LaSalle, hit a couple jump shots. Steve Zach, a sort of unheralded center for them, got really good position and kind of ghosted in for a couple layups early. It was 20-9. The Musketeers turned it around almost immediately. I believe it went from 20-9, and the game was tied at 25. And the first half for me was really about offense, was really about the defense feeding the offense, about X getting into transition, forcing bad shots, getting long rebounds, getting momentum toward the other end, and then using Samaje Kristen and D. Davis's ability in the open court to create opportunities. Brad Redford had a huge game. He was 3-for-7 from threes, 4 free throws, 13 points. Samaje, 8-of-11 from the field. Toward the end of the first half, in sort of a back-to-back game, we also saw Jeff Robinson have a two-minute stretch where he had three dunks, two of them off of offensive rebounds. He was showing none of the hesitation that we saw from him against Temple when he was trying to lay everything in at the rim and missing a lot of bunnies. It was a that last about 10 minutes of the first half was about as well, I thought, as Xavier's played all season long.
I'd agree, and that's what I guess I was getting at before, is we saw some great defense, and you're right, that defense fed the offense, but we really haven't seen this team get on too many rolls the way they did at the end of this first half. And at first it was kind of a combination of Kristen just saying, hey, it's 20-9, I've got to do something, get us back in this game, and he kind of put his head down, went to the rim, got him going, and then Redford comes up with some big plays on offense to keep him going in a big three, and then Robinson's last two-minute stretch that you already mentioned was just, he was everywhere, and that provides such a huge boost for this team, because when those guys are scoring, it just spreads the defense out so much. And we'll talk more about this when we get to the Charlotte game, where you didn't have any of that. Teams want to crowd the lane and be in the lane to take charges and cut off driving lanes for Samaje Kristen. And also, so it's very easy to dig down and double up, or at least offer the appearance of a double team when Travis Taylor catches the ball in the post. When Redford's hitting shots and Robinson's making plays all over the court, offensive rebound, tip dunks, 17-footers like he was against LaSalle in that first half, it's a completely different Xavier offense that you have to defend.
Well, and the quality of X's offensive performance, I mean, you can just see it just from a cursory look at the stat sheet. They shot 57.8% for the game, including almost 60% in the first half. And when you consider that they came out a little bit sluggish on offense, that means that last 10, 12 minutes of the first half, I mean, they must have been shooting about 80% with their looks. And obviously when you get chances like Jeff Robinson was getting toward the end of that first half, you're going to have high percentage shots. It also, I mean, it was a pretty good crowd at CentOS, I think, that day. And when Samaje Christen stole that ball with about 3 seconds left in the first half and almost threw in about a 15-footer at the buzzer that would have made it a 10-point game, that would have torn the roof off the place. That would have been about as loud as we've heard all season. That would have been probably the second loudest we've heard CentOS all season long, because that roar after Redford's second three against Temple was about as loud as I've ever heard that building in the 12 or 13 years they've been playing there. But all in all, I mean, it was a really good effort from X against LaSalle. They held Ramon Galloway to 5 of 16 from the floor. They held Tyreek Duren to 1 of 10 from the floor. Tyrone Garland, another pretty good player, 5 of 12 from the floor, and a lot of his baskets came in garbage time. And Rick, the thing that I noticed defensively that X was doing so well in that game was cutting off dribble penetration.
Well, and Ramon Galloway is tough to do that against too, because he's a guy who can knock down and is not shy about taking perimeter jumpers. In addition to being so good off the bounce and having that mid-range game, I mean, he's a complete offensive player, and you just hit the nail on the head. When he's so willing and you know he's capable of knocking that three ball down, which 3 of the 5 shots he did make were three-pointers, it's really tough to close out on a guy like that who's so good off the bounce. And Xavier was fantastic, whether it be D Davis, who spent time on him, which was shocking because Galloway is a little bit taller of a guard, Christen, who did a nice job on him, or Landon Amos, who was spectacular on him for a stretch there in the first half. They really just locked him up, and just, you're right, the closeouts were textbook.
Yeah, it seemed like every time, it was one of those games where X's defense, it just felt like it came in waves. And every time a guy would get the jump on the perimeter defender, it seemed like there was already help under the basket. And maybe that has to do with the fact that LaSalle's big men aren't particularly good, and that they're not so athletic that you can't slough off them a little bit and sell out on the guards. But when you just look at the box score and you consider individual possessions in that game, it was a really impressive defensive effort. I thought the unsung hero of the game, and you brought him up, I mean, Samaje, 18 points, 5 assists. It's kind of embarrassing to say, but that's almost become expected from him. But I thought the unsung hero of that game was D. Davis, who didn't score much. I think he only had 6 points, but he had 7 assists against 1 turnover. He had a steal. And his on-the-ball defense against LaSalle's guards, who were the strength of their team, was outstanding. And I think the fact that LaSalle turned around just a couple days later and beat Butler at Tom Gola Arena, I guess it was last night by a point, I think that illustrates how good Xavier played against LaSalle, because LaSalle won that game because their guards were outstanding and their guards outplayed Kellen Dunham and Rodney Clark and those guys. And Butler, you know, is a top 10 team at this stage in the season. So LaSalle's a quality opponent. They're a top 50 RPI team, and X really handled them nicely. And it was a very good win for the Musketeers, and it capped off a very good first quarter of the A-10 schedule.
Well, it really did, and I agree 100% with you about D. Davis, which maybe is a good transition point to the next game, which was the Charlotte game last night. Xavier loses that 63-57, and when you look at D. Davis's play from the LaSalle game to the Charlotte game, I don't think they could really be any different. LaSalle game, we're not even sure if he's going to play because of that wrist. It's his first game back. He comes in, he plays like, I think it was like 25 minutes, and gives them great energy off the bench. He gives them great defense that you already mentioned, and he made plays. It wasn't just him scoring or necessarily just all of his assists, which he did have 7 of, but it was just him being a threat with the basketball. It created a lot of ball movement. When you had Samaje driving one way, and then he swung it, and D drove the other way, and then had a quick pass, or even was 2 of 3, so the couple shots that he did take were successful, it creates, if nothing else, the appearance that he's a threat on the offensive end. In the Charlotte game, he wasn't at all, and never even seemed to really look for that, and it really changes the complexion of this offense.
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, offensively against Charlotte, and make no mistake about it, Xavier lost that game because they didn't score enough points. But I made this point on the message board. If you pull up a shot chart from last night's game and you don't see makes and misses and you just see who took the shot and from where, you're going to see a lot of Samaje Christen shots clustered around the basket. You're going to see Travis Taylor shooting from 10 feet and in. Same with Isaiah Fillmore. You're going to see lots of high percentage shots that were close to the basket. And X just could not get the ball to go from anywhere. I mean, and in those cases, it's almost like the offense worked, but the Musketeers just couldn't execute once they got into those scoring positions. And earlier this year, I think when we saw Xavier go through that stretch where they scored under 150 points in three games, they weren't getting good looks. The reason they weren't scoring is because they were forced to take bad shots, and they were sort of taking what the defense gave them. In this game, it felt like X really attacked Charlotte's defense effectively, but they just – I mean, the number of bunnies that were missed, the number of close-in shots that were rejected because a player didn't create enough space for himself or mistimed his attempt – open threes clanging off the iron. It was just one of those games where, I mean, if you're a coach, you're just watching that in addition to some of the other things that were going on out there. And you're just wondering what else you can do.
Well, I agree with you for the most part there, but I always go back and I watch the game a second and sometimes sort of a second and a half as I fast forward through it the third time and just look at a few possessions or a few stretches. And when I looked back at it the second time, it wasn't quite as much the way I remembered after watching the game initially. Because the way last night ended for me after seeing the game, I felt the same way as you, is that man, they executed well, they got a lot of great shots, and then just couldn't make anything. And that certainly was the case to an extent. I mean, there's no denying that they missed a lot of bunnies right around the rim. But the other thing I saw and I noticed is maybe this was similar to some of the other games we've seen in the past where they struggled, in the fact that it hasn't always been that they can't get shots or get looks at the rim, because for one, Samaje gives them that ability just because it's kind of hard to keep him in front regardless. Even if you're playing good defense, he's going to be able to get a shot off. And, you know, they throw it into the post, Taylor, Robinson. These guys can get shots off even if they can't finish them because of their athleticism and sort of the way they operate. And I saw a lot of that again last night, to the point that I realize why Charlotte's very good defensively in the half court. They've got a lot of young talent that is big, physical, athletic. They've got guards, especially Pierre Henry, however you want to say his first name. There's too many vowels in there for me to figure it out. But they are long. They're athletic. They play tough. I mean, they made it hard to score in the half court. So some of those were open, but some of the other ones I noticed, they just had guys leaning on them. They had guys, they were shooting over guys. They had guys right in their face. They had two guys bumping up against them and walling up on defense. Xavier didn't have a lot of ball movement on the offensive end last night. For when I looked back and watched it, there wasn't a lot of the defense having to rotate or get out of position. Charlotte was able to stay very tight in the gaps, eliminating some of the driving lanes, making things tougher on Samaje when he was trying to create. And really, what they did is they eliminated Brad Redford by face guarding him, said, we're not going to let him score. They really didn't pay a whole lot of – they doubled down on Taylor if there was someone right there and there was a non-shooter like Christen on the same wing as him. But they never really doubled off Martin or Redford too much. And they kind of just said, okay, we know Christen and Taylor are going to get theirs, but that's usually only around 14 to 15 a game for each of those guys. Let's shut everybody else down because we don't think they can score and see where that gets us. And that's exactly what happened. No one else scored.
Well, yeah, and, you know, this is probably the first time that Alan Major, the head coach at Charlotte, has had a team that's pretty much his guys. And when you watch that team play, they look like a Thad Matta team.
Exactly.
Because of what you're saying, because of their length, because they seemed to be, and this is a rarity over the last 15 years in Atlantic 10 play, but they were more athletic and stronger, I thought, at most positions than Xavier was. And that's a rare situation for the Musketeers in conference play over the years. On offense, I thought the one thing that Charlotte was getting on offense, they're not a great offensive team, but what they were doing is because guys like Braswell being the number one person who's like this, but also the freshman Clayton. They just are big bodies, and they were just getting great inside position down on the low block. And when you throw it into a Chris Braswell, and he's working on the low block against a beanpole like Travis Taylor or Jeff Robinson, he's going to have a huge advantage of size and strength. And I think we saw that. I think that was the way that Charlotte really kept themselves in the game in the first half when they couldn't hit a jump shot to save their lives. And then in the second half, when a couple of their shots started going down and Xavier wasn't able to score for an extended period of time, they had one of their droughts. Instead of the way X was able to hold Temple at bay and to hold St. Bonaventure at bay during their scoring droughts, they couldn't hold Charlotte out. And that's when that lead went from 1 or 2 points to 10 points. And, I mean, you know, God bless them. This Xavier team just is not built to overcome deficits, especially late in a game like that. So I thought that was really the story of the game, was the way Charlotte's defense finally told the tale in the second half, and then their offense came to a similar level, and they got that big run, and that was it.
Let me throw out two kind of big points from this game that I looked back at too, and especially again the second time I realized the impact. Travis Taylor, if you remember, picked up that big and one to put Xavier up 15 to 10 rather. He had a big and one, finished inside, or I'm sorry, it wasn't called an and one, but he wanted it to be called an and one. Got contact, finished through it. On his way back down the court, he was jawing, got called for a technical. That became his second foul, and that was at the 7:44 mark with Xavier up 15-10. Over the rest of the first half, that's when the last 7:44, both teams were struggling to score, but that's when Charlotte made their run, and Xavier really couldn't find anything to sort of get them going and hold on to that lead. As a result, at halftime, Xavier's now trailing by 128-27. And I felt like the end of that first half, I mean, Xavier had a lot of good things going in that first half right up until about that point. You keep Taylor in the game, maybe they're able to trade buckets, and you keep a 5 to 7 point lead at halftime. Instead, you're trailing by one after a first half in which Charlotte was, quite frankly, dominated for most of the first half. I thought Xavier really outplayed them, and the score didn't quite show it because of Xavier's scoring issues, and then, of course, they're down by one at half.
That was a huge turning point in the first half and in the game as a whole.
Yep.
Because Charlotte had no answer for Travis Taylor the entire game. But because Travis got that second foul at that sort of midpoint stage of the first half, it really took him out of the game, and he was never able to get totally back on track because when he came in, he couldn't play with the same level of aggressiveness he normally shows. And for Travis Taylor, I mean, the idea that Travis Taylor would get called for a technical foul for jawing with a ref, I mean, that just seems so out of character for the kid. It's when we watch him, when we sit on press row, he's not the guy that seems to be bellowing up a storm at everybody on the court. I mean, he acts kind of goofy and he yells at his teammates for the ball, but I was surprised by that. So,
and that's I honestly still don't know that he was talking to the ref. I still think he might have been talking to one of the players that fouled him, because that is
well,
one
with
thing
that
he does a lot.
With that officiating crew last night, and we'll talk about this in a minute, it could have been he could have been reciting a Hail Mary on his way down the floor, and they may have just decided he looked at him wrong. But yeah, and the other thing is that when Taylor goes out with foul trouble, it moves everybody up the depth chart. And let's face facts, last night was a bad night for every other big on Xavier's team. Isaiah Fillmore had, I thought, kind of a nightmarish game on both ends. He's strong enough to stay with Charlotte's big men, so he wasn't dominated defensively, but offensively he couldn't even get the ball to the rim when he got opportunities. And then, you know, Jeff Robinson was in foul trouble from the word go. Eric Stenger, the pace of the game was the pace and he just never seemed to really be in the game. A lot of it because he pretty much got three fouls coming off the bus. And even Amos, I believe, got into foul trouble in the first half. So it seemed like everybody on Xavier's team had two or three fouls going into halftime. And when you have to play for extended periods of time early in the game without your typical rotation, it means that guys are being expected to do things that they're not perhaps accustomed to doing. And you can get away with that at home a lot of the time, or when you're playing a team that's got generally a talent deficit. But against a team like Charlotte that's even up with Xavier, or if not slightly better, that really was a problem. And so that technical foul was a huge segment of the game.
And then going into the second half, the other big point that I had was DeMario Mayfield, the emergence. We know he's a guy who can score the basketball. I mean, we've seen that in the past, and he's their second leading scorer on the team coming off the bench and playing a lot of minutes. So he obviously brings that type of punch to the lineup, but he had been struggling like you wouldn't believe coming into this game. And he even struggled to start the game. And then randomly in the second half, he just starts getting going. And it wasn't just offensively. I mean, he had assists on the offensive end, too, to go with his scoring. And then he had a steal. He had rebounds. He was all over the place all of a sudden, playing with a ton of confidence and getting fired up. He made a couple of threes. He had a nice drive to the rim. I mean, that was one of those things where you kind of look at it and you're like, that's – in a lot of ways, tough luck for Xavier that he just all of a sudden caught fire, because it wasn't necessarily defensive breakdowns. I mean, his 1-3, he had a hand in his face and he was probably three steps back from the line, and he ends up finishing with 13 points on 5 of 12 shooting. It wasn't, you know, a super efficient night. Like I said, he started off slow, but when he got going in the second half, he really gave them a lot of energies on both ends.
Well, and isn't that really the problem that you're always going to run into when you have a team like Xavier that we've talked about it before, that plays most of its games in the high 50s and lower 60s?
Yep,
because
exactly.
All it takes is one 10-0 run. All it takes is one guy breaking out of a slump to knock down a couple threes, and all of a sudden you're in a dogfight. You know, every time we talk about this, I bring up UC, because UC does the same thing. And UC is a better team than Xavier. There's no question about it. But think about the UC-Syracuse game on Monday afternoon.
Let me say this real quick. UC is very similar to Xavier in a lot of ways, just bigger, stronger, and more experienced. But they have the same issues that Xavier does. But go ahead.
But like in the Syracuse game, because Syracuse couldn't score the basketball, they found themselves drawn into a slugfest with UC, who had one guy that could shoot that day. I mean, it was kind of remarkable that UC was in a position and really a very strong position to win that game with as bad as they played offensively. But that's because Syracuse, despite the fact that they're the better team, couldn't get their offense going well enough to put some distance between them and UC. And Xavier's running into the same problem time and time again. When they can score, when they get to 70, like they did against LaSalle, like they did against GW, they're fine, because they are a really good defensive team, and their rebounding effort is picked up so dramatically against Charlotte, a team who we just got done talking about, how Charlotte is so big and tough and physical, and they've got this stereotypical Thad Matta style team. X out rebounded them by 11. And in the LaSalle game, X also had a rebounding margin, a positive rebounding margin, although that one, because both teams shot such a high percentage, there weren't quite as many rebounds to go around. So, I mean, it's a problem that we're seeing time and time again, and you know, it seems to be the theme of this season in a lot of ways. These games, these low scoring games, where X is really always going to be in a dogfight. They always have a chance to win, but they're never really secure because they can't score the basketball consistently enough. And I want to bring up one last thing, Rick. We try not to dwell too much on the negatives when it comes to these games, but this was another opportunity to these losses, because, you know, this was not that surprising of a loss. X was a 4-point underdog in Vegas coming into the game, but this is a perfect example of why X doesn't need all of their role players to produce in a particular game, but they have to have some of them produce. They can't just have the entire roster of role players, whether it be Justin Martin, Jeff Robinson, Redford, in this case Davis, Fillmore. They can't have all those guys kind of draw blanks. And especially from the four position, they got zero field goals out of Jeff Robinson and Isaiah Fillmore combined in 40 minutes of basketball. This X team is not built, unfortunately, to win if they're not getting any production at all from those guys. And you mentioned, and we'll bring it full circle, you mentioned Davis, 1-for-9 from the field. And I don't know how many of those shots were blocked, but it seemed like a lot of them. He's really struggling to figure out how to finish around the basket, because his size just leads to such problems when he tries to go in there with the trees.
Well, and you made this point on the message board today. I'm a little surprised I haven't seen more of. If you remember in the LaSalle game, he came down the left side. He kind of jab-stepped his man in off the dribble, took one step back, and then shot it really off his foot. He was still on the ground, wasn't even in the air. Kind of a little fadeaway float shot from about 12 feet out, maybe a little closer than that. And that's a shot that I had honestly seen him do a lot in high school and AAU. I mean, he was always a scorer. I mean, he was a pass-first point guard, but he could always score. He was a great player coming up. I know that's going to change at the college level because you've got bigger, better defenders, but he still has a lot of craftiness to his offensive game that we just really haven't seen yet since he's gotten to Xavier. And I'm still waiting. I think a lot of it is strength. Some of it's probably just getting comfortable with what he's really supposed to be doing out there, but I'm still waiting to see when we're going to get that out of him, because that little shot right there is one he makes all the time in open gym. I mean, it's a go-to shot for him throughout his career from what I've seen, and it was really the first time I had seen it in a game since he's been at Xavier was against LaSalle. And, you know, again, last night, I remember one play specifically. He had driven in and had two or three guys basically behind him. So he was sort of underneath the rim. And he tried, like, a little reverse layup and literally, like, had two people just jump right on top of it. And fortunately, he was lucky because they knocked it out of bounds and gave Xavier the possession back. But those are the types of things, like, he's just going to have to get smarter about trying to score from outside of the lane. He really can't get in to that box that we talk about so often that Xavier's trying to get to. He's the one guy who really doesn't want any box touches. I mean, he wants to shoot from 6 or 7 feet or farther out and maybe, you know, catch the defense before they get to him. Catch him with a little teardrop or catch him with a little step-back jumper or a fadeaway or something else without getting too close to all these guys who are so much bigger and just seem to kind of swallow him up once he gets inside the lane.
Okay, and then finally we'll talk about the elephant in the room. I hate complaining about officials, especially being a fan of X. There's no way that I can talk about the officiating in a game and be completely objective. I mean, it's just impossible for me to do. But that game last night was abysmally officiated. And you very rarely see a game that's that poorly officiated that leads to as huge a discrepancy in foul shots, in number of fouls called, in critical fouls called, in just comparing specific passages of play one against each other. The one that comes to my mind is Eric Stenger going up to try and dunk the ball at the end of the first half, getting attacked by two guys and basically thrown out of bounds without a foul call. I mean, I mentioned this on Twitter. I really respect the restraint it must take a guy like Chris Mack, who's a passionate guy who gets animated on the bench, to keep his wits about him at the end of that game, because especially that last offensive foul against Samaje Christen, that'd have probably been it for me. I'd have been out there. I'd have been escorted off at that point.
I think it was on Jeff Robinson.
You're right. It was on Jeff Robinson. That's right. And yeah, because it was a complete flop right at half court. The game was already over. As a competitive enterprise, it was a complete flop right at half court, right in front of Chris Mack, and Chris kept his wits about him, which I was impressed by. I don't know if you thought the officiating was as bad as I thought it was. Tell me I'm not just a complete partisan and just a complete homer.
Here's what I'll say about the officiating. I thought there was reaction to this, and this is why I love Twitter. I follow a lot of the people who are on the message board and whoever really tweets with me during Xavier games. I follow them back because I love watching the fan reaction. I love reading kind of where everyone stands. It gives me kind of a good gauge of what people are thinking during the games. And there was tons of reactions to a lot of calls. And I remember throughout the game thinking that I didn't disagree with necessarily all of the calls that people were complaining about. Meaning, individually, most of those calls, a lot of them were 50-50 calls that I really thought could have gone either way. If you're a fan for Charlotte, you're going to say it was a good call. If you're a fan for Xavier, you're going to say it's a bad call. I mean, that's just the way sports are if you're a fan. And in this case, that's how I felt a lot of the calls individually were. But what made it interesting was when you finally get to the box score and you see that 29 number in Charlotte's free throw attempts and you see a 9 in Xavier's free throw attempts, that's a big red flag. And then I go back to the Stenger play, and I watched this a couple times over and over after, you know, like I said, I go back and watch the games. You're talking about Stenger going up for a dunk. And he has one guy in front of him who does get some ball and kind of comes through and hits him like on the wrist and arm too. Then you have another guy, and it was Henry, the guard, who came from sort of behind him, coming down the lane. He was on the block. He comes down the lane, and he does. He blocks the ball, but his whole body flies into Stanger and knocks him to the ground. And in a game where you are calling every single foul, how do you let that go? I mean, you have not let these teams play physical at all. Xavier is in immense foul trouble at the half, and yet you let that play go. I don't. That's the thing that made it weird to me and that I didn't understand. And basically, end of the day, when you were talking about it before, if you play in the 50s, low 60s, you leave yourself open to any little thing making a difference, whether it be a team getting hot for a few shots, whether it be one guy scoring that you weren't really expecting, got hot and made a few shots, like DeMario Mayfield did, or it be the other team gets 10 more free throws you did and 20 more attempts than you did. And that was a huge difference in this game. They scored 14 points at the line. Xavier only scores 4, and there you go.
So we move beyond the Charlotte game, Xavier's last trip to Houghton Arena, good riddance. Musketeers 4-1 in the Atlantic 10, half game off the pace, set by VCU, tied with Butler and those same Charlotte 49ers in second place. The Musketeers now head to Philadelphia to play St. Joe's. St. Joe's, a team that coming into the season, I think everybody viewed as a potential Atlantic 10 contender, potential Atlantic 10 champion. I believe they were number one in the preseason media poll. And it hasn't really – and they – early in the season, they got probably the biggest non-conference win to that point of the season when they defeated Notre Dame in Brooklyn 79-70. Notre Dame's a really good team, top 20 caliber team. But it has been a kind of a disappointing year for St. Joe's. They've got an ugly loss to Fairfield. They got absolutely destroyed on the road by Creighton. They lost to a bad Villanova team. And it's just been it. And they don't really have a whole lot of impressive victories in the conference so far. They played 4 games. They lost at home to Butler by 6 points. No shame there. They lost a close game on the road at VCU. No shame there. But then on Wednesday last night, they were beaten at home by St. Bonaventure in a final score of 73-64. But that was a game Bonaventure led by 20 points early in the game. St. Joe's, at this stage in the season, they're just outside the RPI top 100. They probably have blown themselves out of at-large consideration unless they make a big-time move in the A-10 schedule. So what's your take on this team, this St. Joe's team? Can you get a good read on which way they're trending? And how do you see this matchup against Xavier on Saturday panning out?
I don't think anyone can get any type of read on the St. Joe's team and which way they're trending because you just don't know. And that would scare the hell out of me as an opposing A-10 coach. Because the problem with this St. Joe's team is they've still got a ton of talent. I mean a ton. They, for whatever reason, they are not clicking as a team. You know, we always talk about buying in and all those things. You kind of see this with like UK right now. A lot of people are talking about they're not bought into Coach Cal's system. Good individual talent, but not playing together as a team the way last year did. That's sort of what I see when I see St. Joe's. I mean, they've got some guys who can go. Langston Galloway is great. CJ Aiken is a pro. Ronald Roberts. I mean, they've Carl Jones. They've got all these nice parts. And for whatever reason, it hasn't clicked. Their defense has not been great this year for the most part. And they've got to get better there because, to be honest, they should be one of the best, if not the best, defensive teams in the conference. But then you look at the game. I mean, you mentioned the VCU game, 92-86. The Butler game was a great one that went down to the wire. I mean, this team can play with anyone in the conference. And you never know when 3 or 4 of these guys have a big game and you really can't beat them. Now, what Xavier's gonna have to rely on, though, is the toughness and defensive effort that they've been playing with all the conference schedule. If they can be the team that's more together and be the team that out-toughs them early on and wins the battle in the paint, which St. Joe's, quite honestly, has allowed smaller, less athletic teams to do to them, then I think you kind of set the tone and hopefully keep this St. Joe's team that is struggling beat down and keep them kind of down in the dumps and don't let them get any confidence or momentum going.
Yeah, I mean it's definitely a team that you look at the roster and you look at the stats And you, as you say, they've got four guys in double digits. Aiken is a is an all league type. Aiken can be an all league type player and is one of the most dominant defensive players in the conference. 3.1 blocks a game. Galloway and Jones, a nice set of guards, averaging almost 30 points between them. And then Roberts, just a relentless rebounder from the wing. But you know, it's just a, it's kind of been a typical Phil Martelli team in the post Delonte West, post Marvin O'Connor era. They just can't. They just cannot display consistency over a period of games. And so this is definitely a game that X could go up there and they could get absolutely destroyed. St. Joe's has shown the faculty this year to score a ton of points. They scored almost They scored almost 100 against Iona. They scored 86 against VCU. Up-tempo teams, mind you, but they've shown that they're able to put points up in a hurry. They're a team that has the faculty to go for 80 points, 85 points, which I don't think Xavier can do unless they're playing FDU's JV team. So that's a possibility. But this team also, I mean, they lost to Fairfield. They lost to St. Bonaventure. This is a game that X has to come into feeling that they can win. Now, how important do you think this game is as far as the season goes? This seems like a game that's a hinge for X. I think most people probably expected them to lose at Charlotte. This St. Joe's game feels like almost a pure toss-up and one that could have a lot to do with where X ends up in those league standings.
Well, it does. And here's the problem with the St. Joe's game is – it's a game that could very easily be lost. I mean, you just mentioned that St. Joe's could score 75, 80 points, and Xavier would have really no shot at staying with them. But at the same time, it's not going to look like a bad loss if it does happen. So it is important in the fact that you really can't have this loss. And in terms of just the A-10 standings, I mean, VCU still undefeated, Charlotte now at 4-1, Butler's at 3-1. Xavier needs to keep the momentum going and get this win to stay on pace. And just, I mean, you look at Xavier's schedule coming up. We talked to Mario a little bit about that, and it's not easy. I mean, you've got Dayton going at home, and that's going to be all types. I mean, Dayton's got to be licking their chops right now, thinking this is the year for them. And then you go on the road at Richmond, and Duquesne's terrible. You go there, but it's not going to be an easy finish to Xavier's schedule. And then when you get back down to the bottom, you're at Dayton, at Rhode Island, who's terrible. But then you go VCU, Memphis, and UMass, all three in a row, fortunately at home for X. But
and St.
Yeah,
Louis.
Yeah, and St. Louis.
Fourth game of that homestand.
So there you go. I mean, you're right. This game is going to be important just in terms of staying on track in conference play because it's not going to get easier as we've seen in years past.
Well, NX has gotten back to a point where they're sitting about 65 to 70 in the RPI, which – and I realize the RPI is a blunt instrument. It's not the greatest measure of a team's quality. But traditionally, if you can get to that point, that 65 to 70 point in the RPI at this point in the season, you at least have an outside shot of making the NCAA tournament. X has got a ton of opportunities down the stretch. You talk about the difficulty of the schedule to come, but you can look at that, but there's another side of that coin, which is that those difficult games are also opportunities to notch top 50 victories, to add to that resume, to cover up some of the flaws, the Wofford loss, the Vanderbilt loss. So this is a game, but this to me is one of those games that if X wins it, I'll feel like they've got a chance. If they lose it, I really don't think realistically they've even got a shot at getting an at-large bid this season. And, you know, that's no knock on Xavier. Very few teams could lose the kind of talent that Xavier did this offseason and be in the NCAA tournament picture. But this is a game that X really needs a win in. So you would have to say that this coming week, St. Joe's and Dayton is critical. And if X can get through this with two wins and get to 6-1 in the league, they're going to be looking really strong for that run-in, headed back on the road for two winnable games at Richmond and Duquesne. If they lose this game and, God forbid, lose to Dayton, they're going to be back at 4-3 and probably looking at that sort of slog to 9 or 10 conference wins and hopefully get a favorable draw in Brooklyn.
Well, you're exactly right, and that's actually a great point that you bring up about the fact that there's never been more opportunity in the Atlantic 10 to get quality wins, and there's also the A-10's never been higher profile. I mean, the A-10's getting a lot of buzz right now with some of the great games they've had, with Butler and VCU entering the conference and them just being kind of trendy names in college basketball in general. The A-10 has a lot more notoriety right now and a lot more buzz, I think, and that's going to help come tournament time for all these teams that are kind of on that bubble. If Xavier finds a way to stay there, I think they've got a chance still. I don't think they're out of it, but you're right. This week will probably decide that. Well, we're way over our self-imposed that time limit that doesn't really exist. So I guess we'll go ahead and wrap this up, Dan. Final thoughts, anything to take away from today's podcast?
Obviously, thanks again to Mario for coming on. Really appreciate his insight. If y'all have listened this long, you know, we appreciate it. You probably could have turned it off after Mario's interview and gotten as much out of it. But we are going to endeavor to record episode 20 prior to the Dayton game. It may be a shortened episode, but we do know people probably would like some more in-depth preview of the UD game at home. So we're going to endeavor to do that on Tuesday. So look for a new podcast episode on Wednesday as you wait out the long day till that 9 o'clock tip.
Will the Carter streak end? We'll talk all about it next week on the Dana Victory Podcast, only available on MusketeerReport.com. For Dan, I'm Rick. Thanks for listening, everyone.